hppodcraft.com.
About half a mile outside the village of Llidwood, by the road that goes up over the eastern flank of the mountain called Penny Pwyllt or Rhwystog, is a large farm building known as the Manse. It derives this title from the fact that it was at one time the residence of the minister of the Calvinistic Methodists. It is a quaint, low, irregular erection, lying back some 100 yards from the railway, and now fast passing into a ruinous state. Since its construction in the latter half of the last century, this house has undergone many changes of fortune, having been abandoned long since by the farmer of the surrounding acres for less pretentious and more commodious headquarters. Among others, Miss Carno, the Gallic Sappho, at one time made it her home, and later on, an old man named Williams became its occupier. The foul murder of this tenant by his two sons was the cause of its remaining for some considerable period uninhabited, with the inevitable consequence of its undergoing very extensive dilapidation.
The scene is set, a dilapidated manse with a history of murder. And in spite of its sci-fi sounding name, The Chronic Argonauts by H.G. Wells is at its heart a murder mystery. Ooh. A mystery we will explore here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I'm Chris Lackey.
And I am Chad Pfeiffer. How about our reader this week, Greg Johnson?
That guy is boss, for sure.
The bosses.
He's awesome. He's amazing. He's so talented. And you can hear his other works on my and his show that we did, Quiet and Bold, Adventures in the Paraordinary.
Where can you hear that?
You can hear that at quietandbold.com.
Quietandbold.com. To hear some extraordinary radio adventures of the paraordinary. It's a funny show, so please check it out. Well, we're closing out a month of weird science with a pretty prototypical mad scientist.
Yeah.
This story was suggested by listener Josh Downing. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks, Josh.
He wrote in about the time we were covering The Red Room, also by Wells, and said, hey, if you like H.G. and you like mad science, this is the one to cover. Of course, Lovecraft dug H.G. Wells. He speaks highly of his more spectral work in supernatural horror and literature, and no doubt he read this as well as The Time Machine, which we are going to cover next.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to spend all of June getting into The Time Machine. It's a great story and actually very Lovecraftian in many ways.
Absolutely.
Can't wait to talk about it.
And this story is Lovecraftian in that it's sort of a mashup of the gothic and also sci-fi adventure.
Yeah.
It's a little odd structurally in that it's kind of out of sequence and it doesn't really show you the most major event that happens.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It's somewhat like the Reservoir Dogs of time travel fiction.
Yeah.
You never see the heist in Reservoir Dogs. You never see the real time travel in this. But
no.
Now, this was first published by the Royal College of Science in 1888 and it predates The Time Machine by 7 years. So this is the first time he's really playing around with this concept. Now, Wells would have been in his early 20s writing this, pretty young. He had a long and interesting life, which we may or may not have covered on other episodes. I don't remember. We did The Red Room, The Story of the Inexperienced Ghost, and In the Abyss.
Yeah,
we might have talked about it on In the Abyss, but probably we'll talk more about his life on these upcoming Time Machine episodes.
For sure.
But he's largely credited with the invention of time traveling. I would say he definitely popularized it the most in fiction, the idea of a machine that can take you to a specific date that you request. But there was a story called The Clock That Went Backward by Edward Page Mitchell that was published in 1881, and that has a clock that allows a person to travel backwards in time. So somebody else came in with the machine idea a little bit before him.
Right.
And of course, if you take the machine out of it, you've got quite a few stories dealing with time travel from much earlier. There's one called Memoirs of the 20th Century by Samuel Madden. That's from 1733.
That's right.
And in that, a guardian angel travels to the year 1728 with letters from 1997 and 1998. And it says, "People of the past, heed my warning. It is worth seeing Armageddon on the big screen just for the effects, but you can wait for Deep Impact to come out on video. Both of these movies are just okay." There's a few Lewinsky jokes, but it mostly concerns two films.
Wow.
There's also a story called Anno 7603 by Johann Hermann Vessel from 1781. And in that, a good fairy sends people to the year 7603 A.D., The people find themselves in a society where gender roles are reversed. Only women are soldiers. No doubt very sexy soldiers.
Zap Brannigan?
Yeah, Zap Brannigan guesting today. Then there are the two classics. Of course, Rip Van Winkle by Washington Irving and A Christmas Carol by Dickens, 1819, 1843, respectively. Both involve some time travel. Directly after this as well, there's a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain, which is great. But that was a year after this story we're about to cover. This one here, The Chronic Argonauts. I think this has the best title of all of those.
Even though it does sound like some kind of problem that you have in your lower back.
Or that, or it's the new Cypress Hill album, you know. But But really, despite that Edward Page Mitchell story, I do think that the time machine is a lot closer to what we think of now in this story. So I would say it's kind of the first time machine story. Screw that clock. Let's get into it. Let's talk.
All right. The story starts off talking about this house, and it's got a bad reputation. This guy named Williams was killed by his two sons, and the place has been unoccupied and in progressively more disrepair as the years have gone on.
Now, Wells takes a long time setting up the exact state of the house in all of its decay.
Oh my God, yeah.
And this is the real Lovecraftian part of the story. You got pretty impatient with it, you told me, because you read this before
I did.
Well, I get where you were coming from, but I did think it was very beautiful writing. He talks about the kids throwing rocks to break the windows, which seems to always pop up in these kind of stories with a decrepit house. It touches on how the sounds of the place falling apart lead to rumors that old Williams and his murderous sons are still ghosting around. And there are some really Lovecraftian passages like this. White roses and Deodol creepers that Miss Carnot had first adorned the walls with spread now luxuriantly over the lichen-filmed tiles of the roof, and in slender, graceful sprays timidly invaded the ghostly, cobweb-draped apartments. Fungi, sickly pale, began to displace and uplift the bricks in the cellar floor, while on the rotting wood everywhere they clustered, in all the glory of the purple and mottled crimson, yellow-brown, and hepatite. Well, okay, but let me suggest that these long passages actually have... They actually have an interesting purpose. I feel like they have a time effect all of their own.
Sure.
Because I, like you, I wanted to knock through the story, get to the time-traveling adventures. I want to see, a Chronic Argonaut.
Yep.
But this opening does really force you, if you care about the story, to slow down.
Yeah.
Because rocketing through these paragraphs means missing all sorts of details. And so I had to take a breath.
Uh-huh.
I had to try and stop and smell the mold. You know, it worked. I slowed down for my TV brain. Just let the story go at its own pace. And the cool thing is that rhythmically, the story actually speeds up as it goes along.
It does.
So Wells, intentionally or not, is taking you on this ride that starts slow and builds momentum. So it's as if you're getting on the time machine yourself. I don't know. That's kind of what it felt like. I don't know if that was on purpose. But I'm glad that you warned me, because then I could come up with a way to refute you that these are boring passages. Had you not done that, I might have come to the same conclusion.
Now, in the story, a man has moved into town. Nobody knows where he came from or what he's doing. He doesn't discuss his business with anyone. He just kind of breezes into town and goes straight to the house. Rumor has it that he's an Englishman and that he entered the house via the chimney because he is some kind of wizard or something. And that's what everybody thinks, is because he's a bit of a creep.
Well, a defining characteristic of him that we get here right away is that he just shows up out of nowhere. Nobody really saw how he got there, but he's suddenly there occupying the house. The passage is funny because there's a commonplace story that he showed up by train from London.
Mm-hmm.
But the exact same person who tells that story also tells the one that you recounted there, which it's got crazy details. It says he rode the hills there on an instrument not unlike a sieve
and
came down through the chimney. And a sieve is like a colander or strainer, right?
Yeah.
Which is an odd thing to be riding on. It's pretty ridiculous. But of course, that's actually the story that more people in the town believe.
Of course.
Just because the guy is so odd. They go, yep, that sieve story makes more sense than train.
So the stranger, he's a skinny little dark-haired guy, and he's got very angular features.
It says his features are almost handsome, but they're off a bit because they're all scrunched down under this massive forehead he has. It says below it his eyes glowed like lights in some cave at a cliff's foot. It's his forehead so overpowered and suppressed the rest of his face as to give an unhuman appearance almost.
Mm.
So he's got this giant noggin like the leader or something, which I assume, it indicates his massive intelligence.
Sure.
And he's got yellowish skin, so you can see his temporal arteries pulsing through while he's thinking. And he's got this mop of lank black hair. So you really couldn't look more like a warlock if you were Chris Angel. You know, I mean, he's got that look.
Yeah, that's what I'm always thinking of, Chris Angel. A local chatterbox, Arthur Prince Williams, I guess no relation to the Williams that was murdered.
Ooh, I didn't think about that.
They don't really bring that up.
No, they don't. No relation to Prince either, I assume.
Perhaps. Maybe he is an ancestor of Prince.
Yes.
It does say that he was addicted to funk.
That is in the story.
That's in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But he decided, I'm not scared of this guy. I'm going to go chat him up and find out what's up with him. But no dice. Mm-hmm. The guy just won't open the door to his house. Arthur saw him later by the Pig and Whistle, which is a pub in the village and also an old favorite LA pub.
Yeah, still there.
But then Arthur, he got scared and he hid from him because the guy was just too creepy. And there's lots of stories of this guy creeping everybody out. Some school kids got scared of him and they ran away. Just him walking the street, and that's all it takes.
He already looks weird, but he won't interact with people for anything.
Yeah.
It says inquisitional supposition. exposition, straightforward inquiry, offer of assistance, suggestion of method, sarcasm, irony, abuse, and at last, gauge of battle, though shouted with much effort from the road hedge, went unanswered and apparently unheard. Missile weapons, Arthur Price Williams found, were equally unavailing for the purpose of introduction. So at some point, Arthur got so frustrated that he wouldn't talk to him. He started throwing things at him.
Yeah.
That apparently didn't work either.
So the shopkeeper said the stranger is deaf because he just ignored pretty much every question he gave to him.
Right. He went in to see the shopkeeper to get a bunch of supplies, and he would only point at what he wanted, speak very briefly. But he's probably not deaf because if the shopkeeper did say anything relevant to the order, he would perk up.
Yeah.
He just kind of ignored him as if he were deaf for the most part. But once he's got his food and stuff, he beelines it right back to the man's. He doesn't give anybody opportunity to learn more about him.
He lived alone in this old house. He had no housekeeper or anything like that. And one thing that folks did see is that he got lots of mad scientist gear delivered to the house. The name on the packages was Dr. Moses Nebogipfel, PhD, FRS, NWR, PAID?
I don't know what half of those titles are, but
yeah.
He's clearly an important guy, and also clearly, I think, a descendant of Frankenstein, the scientist, not the monster.
Right.
The way he's very secretive about his work, There's the supernatural air about him, and he's the precursor to Charles Dexter Ward, right? He's out in the farmhouse getting strange deliveries, working at all hours of the night,
And
since nobody can find out anything about him, well, there's just nothing they can do about it, so they let him go on for a while and just whisper rumors.
There's also some strange things that are going on in the mansion as well. Mm-hmm. One night after a festival, some folks are on their way home. They were going by the old mansion, and they heard this loud whirring noise, and then this light just poured out of all the windows and out of all the holes in the roof and everywhere. People heard a cry, like a scream, and then out of the holes of the house, swarms of animals came out, like birds and bats and owls and insects. It's just a real creepy scene.
Yeah, it's a great visual. And he had taken pains to set up that all these animals had over time moved into the house, but this light blasts and they all get out of there at once.
The narrator says that, of course, this could have just been some electric lights.
Right. And that's definitely what it is, because he actually writes, the cultivated reader, which is you and me, will have already discerned that this phenomenon, which sowed a whole crop of uncanny thoughts in the minds of these worthy folk, was simply the installation of the electric light in the manse. Mm. And I think Wells is attempting to show how the people will turn anything they don't understand into something scary.
Right.
But in this time period, most people don't have electric light. Obviously, they don't have electric light, so it is a strange thing.
This went on for days afterwards, the light shooting out of the house, the whirring noises at night, the whirring in the lights, but also the sound of someone groaning, and there was maybe like they were wounded or something bad was happening to them, and the sound would get louder and louder until this person was shrieking.
And the sound is explainable. It's actually coming from a giant circular saw.
Mm.
The doctor is able to draw out pieces of machinery that he wants, you know, sketch them and then send them off, and then they'll arrive for him fully rendered. But many he has to manufacture himself, parts of whatever he's building in there. So they have to hear him all night using this saw to cut metal. We know what that sounds like, but they're not used to it.
Sure.
Of course, to them, it sounds like banshees and monsters and groaning zombies.
So then, of course, there's the instance of Hughes, the hunchback, who was walking by the mansion and then being seemingly attacked by an invisible assailant. Six people saw this happen. And when they tried to help him, his face was purple and his lips were blue and his mouth foamy. Dr. Owen Thomas says that Hughes died of natural causes, but everyone thinks that Dr. Nebogipfel caused it. There's also a story that Nebogipfel was some kind of straight-up magic user. It says here that Nebogipfel had been heard within the manse chanting in conjunction with the Williamses' horrible blasphemy, and that a black flapping thing of the size of a young calf upon therein entered the gap in the roof. That's like straight up demon stuff.
Yeah, that's like something out of an old Hawthorne or even out of Lovecraft. It's definitely scary demon stuff. And that's this gothic atmosphere that's being created.
This fella, Reverend Elijah Ulysses Cook, decided to find out what the heck was going on before these folks get up in arms and grab their pitchforks.
Yeah, he sees that a mob is coming. And all we know is that he goes down to see the doctor.
As that evening, the night that he goes off to see the doctor, grows later, more and more people are showing up at the pub. They're actually literally getting torches. So it's full-on angry mob moving on, going to the place. So a huge group of angry villagers are on their way up to in the middle of the night to get them some necromancer. When they finally get to the mansion, they all just stop at the gate. Some of the kids that, and they brought kids with them, which is like It's women, too. It's women and kids. It's everybody in the village is up there for some good murdering. When they get to the gates, the kids start crying because they're kind of freaked out by the whole thing, as they should be. Everybody's sort of afraid, and nobody really wants to take charge of this whole circumstance.
No, well, it was an organic thing, right? So first you have the drunken men, then you have a bunch of chattering wives behind them, and then because they've neglected all of their children, children come out on their own to follow. It's kind of comic how this ends up, though, because they're all talking so tough when they're at the Pig and Whistle.
Yeah.
As soon as they actually get there, they don't know what to do. Wait, are we really going to go through with this?
But that is until old man Pritchard steps up and says, God wants us to burn a warlock. And he throws a torch down the driveway.
Pritchard is the local religious nut that people are suddenly listening to. They might have ignored him before, but because they're scared, they get on board with this. He's like Marcia Gay Harden's character in The Mist.
Oh, right.
Suddenly the lunatic is the one that's leading the charge.
It's making sense to everybody. So someone else yells, burn the witch, and they're all up for it again. The door to the mansion wasn't locked, so they just burst in, and they're blinded by this light pouring out. There they see Dr. Nebegipfel standing on this brass contraption, smiling at them, half in pity, half in scorn. And then there's this other man. They can't quite see him because all this light's coming at, but he's sitting next to him in a chair. They can't say for sure, but it looks a lot like Reverend Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Others say that it was actually Williams, you know, the man that was murdered by his sons.
His ghost or something.
Yeah, exactly. And there's this mad clamor, and then the doctor and this guy that is with him and the chair are just gone, just vanished.
And that gets us into the second part of the story.
There's this guy known only as the author. He's lounging around outside as the sun sets by the river, looking at flowers, and he sees something on an island in the middle of the river, and it's two guys on top of some machine. He says the thing was not square as a machine ought to be, but all awry. It was twisted and it seemed falling over, hanging in two directions, as those queer crystals called trislinic hang. It seemed like a machine that had been crushed or warped. It was suggestive and not confirmatory, like a machine of a disordered dream. These guys are on this machine in the middle of this island, and then the dude just can't quite believe it, and so he rubs his eyes. He looks up, and the machine's gone, but one of the guys is still there. The description fits that of Reverend Cook. The author, he yells to him, he's like, hey, how'd you get on that island? The guy yells back, Are you in the 19th century? And then the author says, I'm sorry, what did you say? And he goes, are you in the 19th century? And he says, yeah. And he goes, oh, thank goodness. You know, and then this is total time travel movie trope where the person goes, what day is it? And they're like, March 5th. No, the year.
Exactly.
So he tells them it's August 9th, 1887. The man says, heaven be praised.
If that ever happened to me, because they're always freaked out. What year is it? Why would you ask that question? I would just get my checkbook out and start writing the date and then go, what year is it again? Because nobody ever finds that suspicious. They always just think you're thinking of last year, unless, of course, it was like 7:45 and they go, what is a checkbook? They might not understand what I was doing.
The author went away to get a boat and came back to get him and took him to his house where he was just out of it for 10 days.
Right. That old weird science brain fever breaks in.
Yeah, there
and,
you go.
The reverend is incoherent for 3 weeks.
So during this time, the author finds out that this guy is Reverend Cook, and that Reverend Cook had disappeared from his village 3 weeks earlier.
Yeah. And that fixes the period of time. 3 weeks have passed since that mob incident. The reverend eventually comes to and he asks the author, so do you know who I am? You figured it out?
He tells Reverend Cook he knows who he is. And Cook says that he wants to make a statement. So the guy's, all right, sure. Let's write it down. And he says, it concerns the murder of an old man named Williams, which occurred in 1862. This disappearance of Dr. Moses Nebegipfel, the abduction of a ward in the year 4003. And then the author goes, well, huh? Oh, I'm sorry. The year of our Lord, 4003. She would come. Also, several assaults on public officials in the years 17,901 and 2. And the author coughs like, okay. The year 17901 and 2, the valuable medical, social, and physiographical data for all time.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Apparently, he's been on quite an adventure through time.
So the author takes down all that he says, his whole long big story, and then he dies a few weeks later. His body is sent to the village, and now we're into part three.
Which is going to be what the clergyman said, his depositions to this author.
Yeah, so the author wrote basically this third part. So back in July, when Reverend Cook couldn't stop the mob, he figured he would warn Dr. Nebegipfel. That was, we know that. He banged on the door until it slowly swung open, with electric light filling the interior, all manner of mad scientist lab stuff all about. The doc was nowhere to be seen. Reverend Cook couldn't find him anywhere, so he plops on a bench, and then he hears some noises behind him, some crumbling wall or something. And then when he turns back, the doctor is there as a noiseless apparition of Nebegipfel, ghastly pale, with red-stained hands, crouching upon a strange-looking metallic platform, and with his deep gray eyes looking intently into the visitor's face.
The doctor's just appeared, as is his wont, and he's got blood all over him.
The Reverend is freaked out, and so freaked out, he's just paralyzed with fear. The doctor asks, what do you do here? And the Reverend just stares at him in terror. And then he says, what are you doing here? The doctor repeated, what do you want? Cook says, in heaven's name, what are you? And then he passes out. When Reverend Cook wakes up, he's on the floor of the mansion with an unbloodstained Dr. Nebegipfel right next to him. And he's being super nice, and he says what he saw was nothing supernatural, and he offers him a brandy, which you do.
Of course.
That's the behavior. So Dr. Nebegipfel says, it's not supernatural, but mechanical. And then he excuses himself for a minute. He jumps on the platform of the machine, pulls a lever, disappears. Only for a second, and then he reappears. And he says, I was thinking while I was away, would you like to come? I should greatly value a companion.
So he just disappeared and reappeared to prove the technology. Notice the speed at which this is all happening in contrast to the beginning.
Yeah.
Short paragraphs, all action. We're really rolling fast now.
When he said this at this point in the story, when he says, I want a companion, I was like, is this like a precursor to Doctor Who?
Sure it is, yeah.
Because they refer to him all through the third chapter as the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking for a companion to travel through time with him.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an archetype, clearly. It's in Doctor Who. It's also, if we get into the 80s, it's Doc Brown and Marty, right? Because Doc Brown is out making a time machine in a barn, and nobody knows what he's up to, and he needs somebody to go along with him on his adventures. And, of course, that leads to Rick and Morty, which is the same premise.
Yeah.
One of my favorite current television shows.
It
but
is
this guy
so
is
good.
This guy is Rick. He's going to take this unwitting person along with him on some adventures. I especially thought about it when he came back and said, yeah, there's some public officials that we roughed up. I mean, that sounds exactly like
Rick
and Morty adventure. Something just happened.
Cook, still freaking out a bit, managed to say, I'm afraid you'll think I'm stupid, to which the doctor apologizes and says, look, I'm sorry, I haven't talked to a man of your age in the last 10 years.
And this explains a bit of his indifference to the villagers, meaning a person of that era he hasn't talked to in the last 10 years.
Doctor asks him if he's read any fables, like The Ugly Duckling, to be precise. And Reverend Cook says, oh yeah, of course. And the doctor says, well, that story resonated with me. I was always kind of an outcast, and I felt like I would never find my place. And I hoped that I, as a weirdo, would eventually become great, and I did. I became awesome.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man of genius, a man out of time. People called him the Anachronic Man. After 30 years of work, he was able to come up with the Chronic Argo, the ship that sails through time.
It's the development of that time machine, I think, is what he's referring when he says he hasn't talked to anybody of his age for 10 years. I don't think it's because he's been off time for 10 years. Because when he talks about himself, like, I'm a genius and I'm a man out of time, what he means is, I'm so hyper intelligent, I just don't fit in right now. I should be in the future when people know more things.
Right.
And they've developed brains like I have.
Right.
So that's sort of why he's a man out of time. In the last 10 years, he just has cut off. He can't even relate to people of his age because he's been working on this thing that's going to make him a swan.
Right.
This thing that's going to contribute so much to society that it'll blow away his awkwardness of, you know, his previous life. So I think that's what the 10 years are.
That makes sense. Doctor asks the Reverend if he thinks he's crazy, and to which the Reverend replies, it certainly jars with accepted opinions. And the doctor says, yes, it does. Because accepted opinions are wrong lots of the time.
Yes.
And then he gets into explaining that there are four dimensions. This story, like you said, was published in 1888, but the idea that time and space are connected, even a basic kind of general relativity way, had been around for a while. And various authors have been credited to this. W.K. Clifford, with having anticipated the space-time concept in general relativity as far back as 1870. You know, it wasn't as refined as Einstein, obviously. But a publication in 1876, Clifford speculated that the curvature of space is what really happens in that phenomenon, which we call the motion of matter. Specifically, he speculated on the possibility of curved space, not curved space time, which is a little different. But even more interesting than that is that Edgar Allan Poe, in his essay on cosmology, which was titled Eureka, that came out in 1848, he said that space and duration are one.
Poe was pretty smart.
He was, I guess. This is where we get to kind of the conclusion of all this science talk.
When we take up this new light of a fourth dimension and re-examine our physical science in its illumination, continued Nebergipfel after a pause, we find ourselves no longer limited by hopeless restriction to a certain beat of time, to our own generation. Locomotion, along lines of duration, chronic navigation, comes within the range first of geometrical theory and then of practical mechanics. There was a time when men could only move horizontally and in their appointed country. The clouds floated above them, unattainable things, mysterious chariots of those fearful gods who dwelt among the mountain summits. Speaking practically, men in those days were restricted to motion in two dimensions. And even there, circumambient ocean and hyperborean fear bound him in. But those times were to pass away. First, the keel of Jason cut its way between the Symplegades. And then, in the fullness of time, Columbus dropped anchor in a bay of Atlantis. Then, man burst his bidimensional limits and invaded the third dimension, soaring with Montgolfier into the clouds and sinking with a diving bell into the purple treasure caves of the waters. And now, another step, and the hidden past and unknown future are before us. We stand upon a mountain summit with the plains of the ages spread below.
New frontiers and all that.
Yes.
The Reverend is dubious of it all, and he asks if he's speaking literally or metaphorically. And the doctor shows him his paperwork, his blueprints, his theories, all that stuff, the math.
Yeah, and it's starting to make sense to the Reverend. He goes, wow, actually, now that I look at the proof of it, okay, maybe this isn't such a crackpot theory.
So Cook asks him what was up with the blood on his hands earlier, and the doctor gets serious for a moment, and he tells them when he first used it, he found himself in the same room that they're currently in, but from the time before. And when he appeared, there was a man reading a Bible and his two sons. The man was surprised by him and thought that he was a demon or a devil or something and attacked the doctor. In the struggle, the doctor got a knife that was on the floor and he stabbed him.
Uh-huh.
The old man was not, in fact, killed by his sons, Williams, from the beginning in the legend. He was actually killed by the doctor.
Boom. So that's the solution to the murder. And it's a time travel twist. It's kind of the real ending of the story. I think it wants to leave the reader going, whoa, because you have to wonder now, you know, now the townspeople knew about the murders before the doc showed up in town.
Yeah.
But the murders didn't happen until the doctor showed up and went back in time and did it.
Yeah.
Like, how does all this work? Whoa, man.
Yeah, it's kind of mind blowing for the late 1800s.
Absolutely.
At this point in the story, the mob is getting closer and they could hear them crying out, burn the warlock, burn the murderer.
Cook, with a convulsive effort, made a gesture of repugnance and strode to the doorway. A crowd of black figures roaring towards him in the red torchlight made him recoil. He shut the door and faced Nebergipfel. The thin lips of the doctor curled with a contemptuous sneer. They will kill you if you stay, he said, and, seizing his unresisting visitor by the wrist, he forced him towards the glittering machine. Cook sat down and covered his face with his hands. In another moment, the door was flung open, and old Pritchard stood blinking on the threshold. A pause, a hoarse shout changing suddenly into a sharp, shrill shriek, a thunderous roar, like the bursting forth of a great fountain of water. The voyage of the chronic Argonauts had begun.
That's the end of the story.
That is the end, yeah.
I was wondering if H.G. Wells was thinking about maybe doing a series of stories about these guys and their time-traveling adventures.
It seems like it was a setup for something.
Yeah. Yeah, because like you said, they leave out all of this crazy stuff that they hint at, you know, being in the year 4003, in the year 17,901
right.
And 2.
And the Reverend was definitely with him for that, because when he saw the doctor appear on the time machine, that was his first time testing it out.
Yeah.
And it finally worked, you know, because he did the murder and then came right back. So they did this together and they had all kinds of adventures and we just don't get to see what they are.
Well, we don't know that for sure because you remember when he did his little test where he jumped on the platform, disappeared and came right back?
Oh, that's true.
He could have been gone for years.
And he did say while I was traveling, I was thinking about something.
Yeah.
Would you like to go along with me? So I guess he did have a second run of it before they finally chronically Argonauted out. It's all the stuff they got up to on their three-week adventure. We never get to see any of it.
Left to the imagination. I actually thought the story was really interesting if you can get past the first section of it, which was really a slog for me. I had so much trouble getting through it.
I enjoyed it. I was kind of prepared for it. So as a whole, I really liked the story and actually liked that they left the adventure out.
Yeah.
Left me wanting more, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think the purpose of it was to demonstrate, hey, look at this cool thing, a time machine.
Yeah.
And then here's how people would perceive it. And here's a little paradox that it created. And I'll just leave you there. And I thought that was neat.
And then there's going to be even more time travel excitement and fun with Herbert George Wells next month when we cover The Time Machine.
That's right. We'll actually get to see what some of these time traveling adventures are, and they're good ones.
Oh, they're so good.
I want to thank Greg Johnson for reading for us this week.
He is so talented and amazing. Thank you so much, and thank you for tackling the Welsh at the beginning. I want to remind folks to check out Quiet and Bold. Go to quietandbold.com. Get some Lovecraftian drama / comedy action. You will not be disappointed. I promise you.
Awesome. We will be back with more Wells. This has been the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.